Right. Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the LSE for the next of our public lecture series. And it's a great pleasure for me to be able to introduce to you tonight Professor Harvey Marlotch, who's a centennial visiting professor at the LSE and spending his year in the sociology department. It's now, I worked out exactly 24 years ago that I performed a similar role when I was chairman of the sociology department at Essex, and Harvey came as a visiting professor there. I remember my wife and I will remember that he and his family's first question to us after a day fruitlessly running around the metropolitan Colchester was to ask, what's the English word for diapers? Which they managed not to find. And I suppose I could say, sociologically speaking, he's carried on asking the interesting questions since then. His year at Essex was, he left an enormous impression on the department in teaching and in the talks that he gave, and I know that in his year teaching here he's done the same. Harvey has been for some 30 years at the University of California, Santa Barbara. He's made some extraordinary interesting contributions to sociology and field of urban studies, in ecology, in the mass media, in political sociology, and in the work that he's going to be talking about tonight, which is the political economy and sociology of industrial design. His work in all the years that I've known him is totally consistent in its inconsistency, and I think that's true with him as a person. He's managed to do things which most of us can perhaps one of them do, but I think he's done three or four of them. He can take a very serious subject and make it sound funny without losing its seriousness. He can also operate at a phenomenological and ethnomethodological and understanding level, but also at the same time talk about political economy. He can be political about the subjects he works on, but he never uses slogans and never propagandizes. And finally, I think he's also extraordinary in being able to be a mainstream sociologist who knows just about everything that's going on in everybody else's field, but also at the same time innovate and find fields of his own. You know, nobody these days, or perhaps nobody ever, needs sociologists. You know, nobody picks up a phone and says, you know, I'd like a sociologist to come and study us. But I always felt with Harvey that if I needed a sociologist for anything, he'd be the one I'd ask for. If there anything was a chapter that just doesn't work, Harvey would be able to fix it. And he also has the rare combination of not only being a sociologist that you would call upon, but also a friend that you would call upon. And that is rare these days, to find sociology and human beings going together in such a consistent way. And for all those reasons, it's really a pleasure to invite him here to talk on the work that he's been doing on urban design. The title is Designing Stuff. When I looked at his curriculum vitae yesterday, there was only two new things to me. The one was that he was actually currently the director of the Ocean and Coastal Policy Research Center. I assume this is just a complete front for doing something else, which we'll hear about in a few years' time. And also to indicate the range and interests of the way he chooses topics, which none of us would think of as sociological topics, but brings the sociologist's imagination to them. I noticed that an article of his that's forthcoming in the Blackwell Dictionary or Blackwell Encyclopedia of the Cities, he has three entries. One is called Standing Alone, one is called Driving, and the other one is called Swimming Pools. And I think just looking at those titles alone, Standing Alone, Driving, and Swimming Pools, we have some idea of what sort of subjects he's got into. But gets into in a serious way. I think he's one of the most innovative and interesting people in this area. His students have had great pleasure in being taught by him, and as I say, anybody, even on a subject he's not supposed to know about, he knows more than the person who's going to ask him the questions. And with that in mind, it gives me real personal pleasure rather than just professional or academic pleasure to introduce Harvey Marlotch to you tonight. His talk is called Designing Stuff.
Thank you, of course, Stan, for that extraordinary list of attributes, you left out the fact that I also floss regularly. I'm going to today talk about a subject that's occupied me much in recent months and, in fact, years, and that is two things that a number of people conjoin or at least talk about in the same breath that they used to talk about in opposite breaths, if there is such a thing. On the one hand, art, and on the other hand, the economy. And these two realms of art and economy have traditionally, at least, been thought of as something of opposites. I want to argue, and in a way that may be news to some people, that they are not at all opposites, and in fact quite the reverse. They are conjoint and in fact, constitute one another on a continuing routine and never-ending basis. First of all, let me just say what I mean by art, which is the more vague of the two things. By art, I mean all kinds. I mean popular art. I mean fine arts. I mean expressivity, erotic art, the sublime, fun, toying around, fooling around, screwing around, the spirit, romance, all of those things. By the economy, I mean not only the formal economy, but those aspects of life that we think we engage in because they have an end product which is useful, that is, there is utility. We're doing something that is functional. There's functionality to it. It's the hard side of things as opposed to the soft side of things. It's the practical. It's the rational. And what I want to do is to argue that they are conjoined. Now, ordinarily, there's a kind of squabble between these two sides, between these two realms. And so the history of art, and the history especially of the history of art, is one in which people treat the commercial as the very opposite of art. And indeed, the phrase commercial art is for some a contradiction in terms. On the other hand, those who are engaged in economies and the productive apparatus often look at art as a frou-frou, something that in the corporate world they might engage in, but they do maybe as a favor or to display that they have some high status attributes, that they have cultural capital in the term that we now use, and it's appropriate that it be have that connotation of still another kind of practicality, and only in that sense would we kind of admit it in to what we do as serious, hard-headed, practical, rational, utility-oriented, utility-maximizing type people. But I want to do today a demonstration, if I could. I want to try to convince that, in fact, these two realms are very much implicated in one another. And I want to start, I want to start with a little bit of an exhibition, which is only to, it is going to be very brief as I take you through the history of art, with however just, I think it's three or four slides. This is a painting by Mondrian. It's 1909. Mondrian, many of you know, is one of our most influential modernists, and indeed working in and out of the Bauhaus school in Weimar, Germany, had a tremendous influence not only on art but also artifact, and that's. Brings me to this chair. This is a chair by Le Corbusier, 1928. So about, in other words, several decades beyond the Mondrian painting, we get this chair. And besides the chair, now we've gone forward. I told you we're doing the history of art. And this is from the 1980s. And this is a forklift truck. And I think that this is a Mondrian in a chair. We'll go back to Mondrian. Many buildings all over the skylines of the world are Mondrians in buildings. This is a Mondrian in a chair, and then this is Mondrian in a forklift truck. And so the history of art is also a history of artifact. And I would argue that this is only at the high end of things, an illustration of what is a much more pervasive process. That is, every object in the world that we touch or see is designed. It's designed by someone. It may be a professional designer, it may not be. And every object that we see or touch also has a heritage, which is outside of design itself and goes back to the history of art. And every piece of art goes well outside the boundaries of something like fine arts. That is, all the arts, all the modes of expression, from the bottom, from the top, are intricately interlinked. And so when we see the world around us, what we are seeing is a kind of residue coming at us in these ordinary objects, these manufactured objects, which contain within them the history of all art and the history of all artifact. And art, again, in that widespread, all-encompassing mode of thinking that I described a moment ago. Well, how does this process work? How does art, in this very large sense, get into artifact? How does art, in various ways, drive economies onward and become an essential part of production? Well, I want to just outline a few of the different contrasting ways in which I think it works. First of all, people use art, again in this large sense of the term, to see a solution to a material, an economic problem, a trading problem, a marketing problem, a production problem. People have what Schumpeter called pre-analytic visions, a pre-analytic vision. That is, before one sets about answering, solving a mathematical problem, balancing an equation, or developing a business plan, or scheming a new chair, there is a kind of vision that catches hold that is prior to and not represented ever in the business plan, in the process. And that fantasy, that dream, that notion, it comes as a kind of bolt of art and indicates something like what form the solution will take. And scientists never, when they publish their journal articles, but when they get old and write their memoirs, often cop to all of this and acknowledge that we, for example, as some people say, think in pictures, that when I do equations, they have to be beautiful. That's what leads me on. And that in some way or another, it was this pre-analytic vision that I was infused with, worrying about, motivated by, inspired by, and that gave me a sense of where I needed to go, what the solution would look like when I come to it. The assembly line, I mean, as I like to say, Henry Ford's assembly line actually had a number of steps that led to it. One was the disassembly line. It began at the meatpacking plants, and Henry Ford saw animals going by on an assembly line, and people took it apart. And then he got the idea, I can reverse that. I can put it back together. But before even the disassembly line existed at the meatpacking plant, someone had to have, I would argue, something like that kind of a notion. And that, again, a pre-analytic vision would be very helpful. Sometimes, as in the example I just gave you with the Mondrian, the relationship is more formal and can be seen as related to the history of fine art, as opposed to a drug trip or a dream in the night. And I'm now going to give you an illustration of that process. I've been interviewing industrial designers primarily in the United States, but to some degree all over the world. This involves what you're going to see here is a bathtub coming into reality. And this, I think I've got it backwards, don't I? This is was a bathtub designed by a British firm for an American client. The American client is American Standard. And as they began their work, they began by fooling around with concepts, but the concepts were from Matisse. Matisse and also a wall at the University of Virginia that was designed by Thomas Jefferson. And in fooling around with those forms, they started to get near to a bathtub. There's the Matisse. I should have put them in that order. And then the Matisse starts taking form in a bathtub. And then along comes, lo and behold, some ergonomic studies, which people who are doing bathtubs typically do. And then comes the bathtub, not very well lit. But there are a couple of things I want to show you about this bathtub. This is no ordinary bathtub. And there are a couple of things that are extraordinary about it. First of all, it was extremely expensive. So in the U.S. market, it sold on the order of about $5,000. So this bathtub never made any money, and it was never meant to make any money, really. It was to cater to the highest-end luxury market. But the company, American Standard, instructed the designers to give me a bathtub that will anchor American Standard as the prestige, luxurious bathtub company. So the idea is that people take baths in part as an aspect of kind of a sensual, hedonistic moment. And to be able to say that you're the bathtub or you're the bathtub company that implies such a moment, and this is the way they thought about it, means that it's worth it to put one out even if you don't make money, because you can define the company by its highest end bathtub. In fact, they did okay on this bathtub. It caught on big in the Middle East at just the right moment. And so it worked out fine. One of the things they were held back, though, with this bathtub is that designers can't just design anything, because they're aware of something called type form. Type form means that people have an expectation of what a product should be. A bathtub is called a slow turn object. Slow turn meaning that people don't buy very many in the course of their lifetime. And so they are extremely conservative about their bathtub. It means that they want their bathtub to be hard and glistening, even though more people die in hard and glistening bathtubs than almost any other way. I think I'm safe more or less with that. But their technology exists easily to make what a soft tub, that is a tub that will in fact give a little. And yet no one's been successful in being able to market a soft tub or even make one, because the companies are afraid that people are too in love, they too come with a notion of what a bathtub must be. And so it's an arena where you can't experiment too much. The other thing is that a bathtub, and some things are like this and some things are not, a bathtub has to fit into a pre-existing set of arrangements, not only mental arrangements, like I know what a bathtub looks like, that is not a bathtub, it's not hard, but also a set of other hardware arrangements, like the pipes, the faucets have to be where the pipes are. And because bathtubs seldom look like this, the controls are here. That's where the controls are, so there, it means that the plumbing's got to come in on the side. But bathrooms are not developed that way. Neither old bathtubs nor do builders, when they put in new bathrooms, want to go that route. So this starts illustrating one of the interesting things about products and the process of designing products, and that is that at the same time that you're doing something that is artful, you are also responding to all sorts of context, including the aesthetic visions of other people, what is a bathtub, as well as the hardware realities that are already out there. That is, where hot and cold already is situated in the plumbing system of the room. And so working through that process and putting your product right on the line is indeed the goal. And it's the part of the skill of people who do this occupation of design is to find that that soft spot, that magic spot, and hit it, and in that way make a splash, so to speak. Now, so one way, though, let's get back to the main point, one way in which art gets into the economy is by visualizing it, in this case, through very consciously and self-consciously a fine art piece. And sometimes people are doing that. Most of the time, they are not. They're grabbing from the vapors of images and experiences they've had to come up with something that they think other people might want, fitting it into all kinds of other contextual details, like in this case where the plumbing is. Another thing that people do, another way in which it works, is that art, in this large sense of the term, sells products. In this case, I would argue that Matisse et al. Are helping to sell this particular bathtub and to give it the kind of market at the high-end prestige place that it was meant to sell, its niche, that would make a go of it. But in the same way that the shape and Matisse help sell this tub, it even at the trivial level, the texture of a doorknob, the texture of a pen, people who make pens are extremely conscious of exactly how it feels. That it is to them as critical a feel as the most erotic moment that anyone has, and just as real in terms of its consequences. They worry very much about things like that. And so do the people who design cars, how the handle feels, the sound of the door when it clicks, the sound of the handle when it's raised, all of those things. The look of a dental drill, the look of a piece of factory equipment. Every product has what I like to call a semiotic handle. It's not just there. It's something that you hold, you approach, you touch. And the aesthetic aspect of every object that we see is a handle. It says, touch me, come here, grab me this way, not that way. And we'll have a good time. I'll wash your dishes. Or I'll move your stuff around. In the factory. Sometimes this happens at a very, very high level. That is the way in which design sells products and moves fortunes around. At the most macro level, we know that the search for gold and spice, glitter, gold is pretty much a worthless material except what's in my mouth right now, utterly worthless. And spice is an artful item. We don't need spice. There's no nutritional value in spice. Gold and spice they help provide semiotic handles to other things, but in themselves, they are not functional. But of course, as Werner Sombart, of all people, really is the one who laid this out many, many years ago, that it's the search for trivia, for style, for fashion, for gold and spice that led to the great navigations, transformed the world, not just navigation itself, but the ecology of the earth, all set in motion by the search for, can you believe it, glitter and spice. It's no wonder we spend so much time talking about, well, where should we eat tonight, Thai or Mexican? And worry so much about our cooking. We sometimes might treat that as trivial or not in tune with what history has been about, but history has been about something like that. Well, let me show you a little bit, just one more example. Chandra Mukherjee, who is a sociologist in the United States, has written about a number of interesting things, but one of them is the textile industry. And out of those writings come some, I think, fascinating points. The textile industry in Britain was threatened by what was called the rage for calico, that is, in prints that were made in India. And this threatened, in effect, the Industrial Revolution, because textiles and the Industrial Revolution are not incidental to one another. This led to a transformation of the British textile industry in order to be able to produce fabric that was hard enough to take calico and cheap enough to produce such that it could compete with what we today call low-cost labor. And indeed, it triumphed. And things like the water frame and many other innovations in British textile production came about to service the calico taste. Later on, just skip forward several hundred years, it is the British who are flooding India with imports. Because, in fact, the British can make printed cloth cheaper than can be made in India. And the taste for British cloth in India is higher than for Indian cloth within India. And it is Gandhi who led the campaign, and a very important part of Gandhi's campaign is the campaign in favor of domestic Indian cloth. And that became both a symbol of the transformation of India, the anti-imperialist transformation, as well as a concrete consequence in terms of trade and the capacity of the Indian people to develop their own indigenous textile industry. In this case, style is played out in a large-scale political set of realms in order to transform a society and its role in the world. Let me give you some less gigantic trans-historical phenomenon. These are alarms that are smoke detectors, which we have in the United States. I don't detect them here. These damn things are put on ceilings, and when smoke happens in the house or anywhere else, they go off. The great problem with them is they go off falsely, constantly. Typically at dinner parties, because you're cooking and the guests are arriving and smoke starts going up from the stove, and that's when they go off. And so you have to find a ladder and climb up and disconnect them. And what happens is a lot of people just disconnect them, period, because they don't want this happening, thus canceling out the functionality of the product. Well, this is a company that's new to the industry and has taken, it's called Coleman, which makes camping gear. But they got onto this, and they've got, I'm happy to report for those of you who have stock in Coleman, 40% of the market almost immediately. And what they did was redesign them. These are, take my word for it, much more handsome than the prior generation. But more critical than them being handsome, or actually an aspect of being handsome, is that this is a button that accepts the top of a broom handle. And you don't only have to be told that once, and then you know how to work it. And so in this case, the semiotic handle is very obvious and contributes to functionality, and indeed maybe is a matter of life and death. Speaking of which, this is upside down, but what do you care? This is devices for heart surgery, something that few in this room have seen in use. This is the same device. This is before industrial design, and the top one is after industrial design. And I'm going to give you the... And there it is, schematically in use. And what you can see is that by turning this knob, you open the body. And although we assume that everyone who's doing open heart surgery on us knows what they're up to and are pretty good at their task, no matter how the product is designed in detail, I would much rather have this one inside me than have this one inside me. Because, of course, the doctor could have a little human error that day, a little bit up too late, a little bit dulled in various ways. And so having a product which is designed in such a manner that it invites proper operation is something that you, I think, want to indeed have happen to you. And here's another example of the way these two things work hand in hand, what architects call form and function, what designers call form and function. And that is the Taurus automobile. The Taurus automobile, what's it called in this country? It's not called Taurus. It's not here. But there's something like it here. It's a Ford product. It was the best-selling car in the United States, and it was on the market in its first incarnation for a decade, essentially unchanged. That is an extremely long market run. When you see industrial designers, by the way, and see how they work, you learn very quickly that things like trying to make something have a short life is not what they're about. They would like their competitors to design things that have short lives. But for them, the whole goal is a very long production run that is vastly profitable because you don't have to retool, you don't have to transform your dealership network, you don't have to change your marketing strategies. That's exactly what you want to do. And Ford had a vast success. One of the things that Ford did was have an asymmetric design on its interior. Prior to the Ford Taurus car, cars tended to have, they tended to be Bauhausian, crisp and rectilinear, which means symmetrical. And that means that when you're sitting at the wheel, since the two sides, the two panels have to be identical, it means that the driver is many times doing awkward reaches in order to gain control. Whereas in the new Taurus, everything the driver needs just gets clustered around the driver's driving wheel, or at least that's a very strong tendency, and then the least likely things to be used are put on the periphery near the passenger. What has happened, and maybe we'll go back a couple to the bathtub, this bathtub is not symmetrical. Now, we've all been in bathtubs, and one of the things that's the case of them is with them is they are symmetrical, which means that you lay in the tub and you have to reach forward, no doubt another source of many calamities. You at least will drop the soap, if no other thing, if nothing worse, and then you reach and make your regulation. Here, and I don't work for this company, but the controls are right where your hands are. But what blocks this, on top of all the other things that block this from becoming common in the marketplace, is that we are used to a symmetrical bathtub with the hot and cold on either side of the faucet. And this runs against symmetry. Now, I would argue that this tub, it has been given to us. It is because of Matisse. It is because of Kandinsky. Kandinsky did not work symmetrically. And so many artists, folk, fine artists, kids, have prepared our eyes for a lack of symmetry, at least for some of us, in some market segments. And so in this case, an art sensibility, art in the large sense, gives us something which is more functional, in this case, a way to operate a bathtub, and in the same way, also, a way to operate an automobile dashboard. Whoops, I'm not ready for that yet. Things like the Beaubourg Museum and architecture, which has all of its appliances on the skin, and that sort of thing, has also that's all been prepared for us by, I think, currents in the art world, both fine arts and popular art as well. One of the ways in which this has happened is in automobile and automobile industry. And so let's go continuing to discuss the ways in which art and expressivity moves economies and makes things happen in the material world. Sociologists, economists, when they study the history of the automobile industry in the United States, treat the great breakthrough as the formation of General Motors. And in particular, the genius of General Motors, they say, was their organizational form, which they call the M form, for multi-divisional form. Having five automobile divisions, Buick, Cadillac, Oldsmobile, Chevrolet, and Pontiac, there I can do it, having those five divisions compete with one another was said to be the brilliant breakthrough that caused General Motors to take over the automobile industry in the United States and much of the world. Well, when you look at the history of that industry, you see that another thing happened. And the other thing that happened at about the same time as the M form is that General Motors hired a man named Harley Earl, who was designing cars for Hollywood stars, customizing them in Los Angeles, hired Harley Earl and brought Harley Earl to Detroit. And Harley Earl began what they called in Detroit Hollywood styling. And this is where the left critics got all of their stuff about annual model changes and all the waste that is contained within that. But a number of other things happened as well. First of all, the public went for it and it meant that General Motors destroyed Ford Motor Company. Ford Motor Company almost went under. Henry Ford's slogan was, any color you want as long as it's black. He produced a reliable car, but by 1926, the Ford Motor Company was about finished and had to carry out the most expensive retooling operations in the history of any industry. And it was extremely expensive for him to do because the Ford plants had the equipment set so close to each other, each piece, that it wasn't easily retooled. Pieces weren't easily substituted for one another. And so the tools themselves were not set up to deal with design change. General Motors not only killed Ford by annual design changes, but also killed Ford by setting up a factory regime which could reassemble cars in different ways, what today we might call flexible production, and keep that going on a continuously changing basis. In more material terms and concrete terms, although that's, I guess, pretty material, General Motors, as part of styling, insisted on a single rolled body so that the car would have very few parts. That one thing that meant was that it was cheaper to produce, but the main thing that drove it was so that they could get styling effects that they wanted, including the hardtop car, which meant a car that looked like a convertible, had no pillars in the windows. This was an engineering challenge for the General Motors engineers, and they triumphed. The rolled steel technologies that they created then had an impact everywhere else. And rolled steel, once it could be done for cars, was done for appliances, for factory equipment, for building infrastructures, for many, many other things. I'll give you another example. Styling wanted the trunk to disappear. Trunks on cars, and you can try to do some flashbacks to your life in the 1920s, trunks on cars were like trunks, like a trunk you travel with, stuck on the back of a car. And then the extra tire was stuck on top of that. And for styling reasons, they wanted to get rid of it to make the car more streamlined, a term also that was coming into existence, and coming to existence in part through the Italian futurist painters who were then having an influence on French art, and so that all was rolling in that direction. In any event, it happened, of course. The trunk was eliminated as a visual phenomenon, and the spare was put inside the car. This then became a permanent part of the car. We no longer think of this as an aesthetic treat or as a styling element. We think of it as a natural thing of what a car looks like. And indeed, because they did that, it turned out that that was much more efficient aerodynamically. It means that there is better mileage. It is cheaper to produce. And it is more secure so that the trunk cannot be broken into as easily. And now, of course, you can get access from the cabin of the car, and all sorts of more wonderful things have happened. The point is, again, it was the sentimentality of taste and emotionality that drove this forward. And I'm buying into all the critical stuff about what cars are. That is, that they are erotic, it's sexual, it's exciting, it's triumphant, all of that stuff. But I'm putting a new light on it. Rather than treating it as a trick of capitalism to oppress people, I'm just talking about the way in which these two things, these two phenomena, art and economy, operate together, holding off the judgmental armory for just at least another few minutes. Another thing that happens in this connectivity is that art holds a practice in place. Many things are done for artistic purposes, and it takes a while before they are applied to other purposes. People will do zany things, the things we do for love, as they say, we would never do to make money, or at least we would not have the driving imagination and fortitude to carry forth in the way that we will for the sentimental, the sensual, the hedonistic. So, for example, one which is got a bad name, Versailles. Is where plumbing took place, not only inside, but to make the fountains work. It was the site of the greatest advances in plumbing. which then got transferred a good deal later, to mining, hydraulic mining, and the capacity to drain mines to make take mining where it had never prior been. Hydroplating was developed for the purpose of decorating plaques and cutlery and other fancy products. In other words, to put a shine of gold or other quasi-precious metals on what were baser metals. But this created the first market for electricity, the first steady market for electricity, which led to a market for batteries, which then led to a market for hydroelectric power. It provided a kind of stable base for all of these things, and also for circuits, printed circuits, which are essentially printed in the same way that electroplating works. Glass. Glass was developed for the purpose of decoration, for beads, for prisms to have light play, out of which came the science of optics, out of which came telecommunications. Another application was test tubes and other scientific equipment, which allowed it to be to see scientific interactions take place before your very eyes in a way that couldn't be done before. Wheels. Let's talk about the wheel. The wheel was invented, so they say, for purposes of ceremonies, for wheeling in great deities and representations of, and for conquest, for military uses. It wasn't a straightforward utilitarian thing. One of my favorite examples are polymers, plastics. Our world, plastics is the thing. We should have all taken heed of that in the movie The Graduate. Plastics was where it was going to be. Plastics were developed first for billiard balls and piano keys. And the first 100% artificial polymer was developed by a man named Leo Bakeland, who was British, and his product was called Bakelite. And out of that came the future of the plastics industry. But the first applications were for recreational purposes. Now, there's a metallurgist named Cyril Stanley Smith, who is not alone, but he's where I first read the following claims, which are the most outrageous of all. And that is that language came out of singing, again, playing around. That came first. That pets, people had pets, and there's some archaeological evidence that suggests this, prior to animal husbandry. And that people grew flowers prior to agriculture. Fireworks came before rockets. And cubism was the mechanism of camouflage. And in fact, cubists created camouflage. The French, during the war, hired cubists to do that sort of very thing. Toys are everywhere the source of inventiveness to just get to the biggest toys of all. Bikes, cars, airplanes all began as toys. They began as adventures in racing, created by amateurs who were striving to enter in tournaments and make their thing go. Sometimes the need is to deflect business out of its seriousness, because sometimes business doesn't see that the toy function of something is actually its most important. And by toy, I mean amusement, aesthetic, hedonistic. So, for example, Thomas Edison was upset that the phonograph was being used for music. He thought it would be a business tool, that it was a serious product, and resented the fact that people were using it to entertain themselves. The tape recorder was invented in the United States by a company named Ampex, which marketed it as a business enterprise, as a business tool again. It was Sony, called then Tokyo Electronics, which saw it as something that could be used by people having fun and also to entertain one another with musical recordings. And out of that, the great Tony Empire, Sony Empire, the Tony Sony Empire, in fact, came to be. The computer, which of course is so major part of many of our lives, the computer has had an up and down history. across many, many spheres. The military use of the computer was extremely important. I think we all know that. But the market for the computer was always thought to be business, as opposed to a pleasure or the home. And there's a historian of technology who's, I think, the best. His name is George Batsala, and he's done, I think, just the extraordinary work. But George Batsala made a terrible mistake when he published the following words in 1988 in his major book on the history of technology. Quote, "By the mid-1980s, the home computer boom appeared to be nothing more than a short-lived and, for some computer manufacturers, expensive fad. Consumers who were expected to use these machines to maintain their records, educate their children, plan for the family's future, ended up playing electronic games on them, an activity that soon lost its novelty, pleasure, and excitement. As a result, a device that was initially heralded as the forerunner of a new technological era was a spectacular failure and threatened to bankrupt the firms that had invested billions of dollars in its development." That's a lesson in watch out what you say. You can never be too nervous when you're writing. But also that anybody can be real wrong, as he turned out to be a wonderful, wonderful scholar, George Batsala. But it was easy to make that mistake because there is this running bias against thinking that something like people playing games with their computer, in effect, is going to undermine it and not create for us a solid and stable market, a stable future for a product. He was wrong. I'm just going to give you one or two other commercials for art and the way in which it operates in the industrial process. It coordinates diverse individuals. Art is about idiom, genre, formula, modality. The geographer Michael Storper has written these more recently about conventions and about the fact that what makes an area, a region, productive is the conventions, the social conventions that are in that particular place. That is, people know how to do things. So that in, for example, what we now call the Third Italy, the Tuscany area, there are conventions there about how you cut cloth, conventions about understanding style, conventions about deadlines and how people work together, that those people share. And that sharing of that commodity, of that set of knowledge, makes that place be, which it is, the largest producer, the largest exporter of clothing in volume, of dollar volume, in the world. In the same way, Hollywood is held together by conventions, genres. We're going to make a murder mystery, going to be set in so-and-so. It's going to be like Agatha Christie, but everybody's going to be black, and it's going to be set in the 1920s in Alabama. And then people go, right. And then that means that the people who are doing the video, the people who are designing the credits, get on with it. And this complicated project in which different kinds of people are going to be working together have some sense of what it is they're going to be doing together. What the aesthetic carries forward in people's lives and in the life of a region is tacit understanding. Art is about tacitness. Washing machine instructions are not art. Art is about that which is not articulated and cannot be very easily articulated, yet represented in a way in which people share a sense of what it is we're all about and what it is that we're doing. And so whether it is visual art, the look of a building, the opera house at Sydney, or a narrative storyline about what we are, about how Italians live together, and what Italy and the Third Italy stand for, it makes it happen. I think that the city in London and the financial world is held together similarly by stories and a sense of a common history and an orientation toward a prospectively similar future. And in that set of scenarios are idioms that, in being something that people share, provides a way in which behavior can be coordinated even when it is not explicit, even when it is not stated, a way of carrying on together. Related to all of this is that it's the way in which regional economies are held together. I've mentioned Hollywood, I've mentioned the Third Italy, and I've mentioned the city. There are other ways as well in which the aesthetics of the place, a kind of way of doing things, is smelled by other people who want to, for example, see it right up front, which is the source of tourism and is a major industry in itself. A way in which it puts out adverts, in effect, to other people that this is the kind of place you might want to move to, and inaugurates selective migrations of the kind of people who connect with that storyline, with that idiom. And so the place becomes more and more like it was, and its profile becomes reinforced, and its way of producing becomes increasingly effective in that kind of way. And it also acts as a mechanism that causes people to want to have stuff that comes from that place. And so Max Factor, who invented pancake makeup in Hollywood, advertised that 9 out of 10 Hollywood stars recommend that product. Hollywood, Paris, London to some extent, all these places are used to sell goods on the concept that the goods come from that place. And so people who want to be part of that world, who want to imbibe it even though they can't be there, even though they might not even be able to be tourists, can have some of it, can be like Paris, be in Paris, by using that kind of product on their body and that kind of perfume in their on their armpits and that kind of product on their face. There is a kind of future for all of this that I'll just mention in closing. And that is that some of the arguments and ideas I've been putting across are, or tried to put across, are not unique at all to me and the sentiments I've been expressing, but are increasingly self-conscious. People have a sense in the industrial world that design sells. This is a car design, a car advertisement in the United States. It's in Upside Down. It's a Lincoln Mercury advertisement. And if you were dyslexic, you could see that it says something like, the piece on the top is missing, which says, this is a man's car. That's the way they advertise that. I think that's pretty good. But they sell the car by virtue of the sociality that is surrounding the car. Here's another version. You see a certain tendency in my slide operations. But this was a constant. There are hundreds and hundreds of these kinds of ads for Cadillac, showing them in a luxurious setting the couple just like you want to be when you grow up, and if you buy Cadillac, you'll look like that. But here is the Lexus automobile, in which the car is mounted on a plinth as though it were a sculpture. And if you look next time you're on an airplane or at the doctor's office, it's the best time to do this kind of research, not British doctor's offices, where the magazine selection is way low. I don't know if that's part of the National Health Service reform or not. Automobile ads now feature the piece, features the car as a piece, as art. And often the word design is in fact used and sometimes used very, 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 very often in the process. Here's a woman who is sizing up the car. So rather than as a design piece, or rather than the woman being on the hood in the old style way, the woman is indeed gazing at the car. It is her object rather than the other way round. One other process that I want to end with, and that is, this is an ad for Jane Barnes. Jane Barnes is a company, like now many famous companies, well, this was not all that famous, but like many companies, that makes nothing, although it's a company that is in business that does stuff. I mean, it's a stuff company. And the stuff they do is both men's clothing, which you see that man wearing, and chairs, like you see that man sitting in. And so a company does chairs and it does clothing. Two odd kinds of things. What is going on? This company, what is about is the name. And what they do is rope off a group of people who would sit in a chair like that and wear a suit like that. And then by the value of the company, the equity of the company is having captured that group. And with internet sales, which loom as bigger than anything we've ever seen, the internet will be about coming up with an address, like one I've had a lot to do with lately in New York is called bikini.com, which is ladies Baywatch. It's ladies cavorting in bikinis, but out of that will spawn this beachwear site in which they will sell people who like to look at ladies in bikinis all the stuff they need. And they'll buy it, however, with just a punch, so no trip to the store will be necessary. Besides the internet, I call this logocentrism, by the way. The idea that the logo, the brand, is what it's about. I learned recently where the word brand came from. The word brand comes from Brandia, and Brandia is the name given to religious relics that were supposed to have been in proximity to the saints. So it's and the martyrs. In other words, when the Romans were and when the Pope was selling off the stuff from the burial places, which he did, and giving it to churches all over Europe, and then they were building a little tourist industry around it, and it was this was the merchandise of those places, the stuff that was on the body. That was, of course, extremely good stuff. All that stuff, Brandia. And so building Brandia and all of those associations is what it's all about. What I've tried to do is to show the way in which the stuff that we see all around us is there, and it's really not stuff at all. It's actually in the mode that it was produced, and if I'd have time, I would have talked to you about the way also in which it is consumed. It is about not having material. It's not about doing the rational. It is not about maximizing utilities. It's about following through stories. It's about satisfying social yearnings. It's about sentimentality. It is about social solidarities. And it is about a satisfying emotional life. So if we see those facts as not the result of a capitalist trick, which is the way critical theorists have dealt with it all, that is that it has all been about a seduction. It has been about making people have false needs, making them think that they can satisfy their emotional life by having stuff. And so therefore, if we just end the trick, then the role of stuff will recede, and it will no longer have a kind of drive. It will no longer be a driving motor in society. If we relax that orientation and don't see it as a trick, we can see it, I think, much more closely for what it is, which is a kind of continuity with what Mary Douglas and some other anthropologists, Daniel Miller here at the UCL, there at the UCL, has done in his studies of consumption, that in fact these things are means of human expressivity and solidarity, and that the way human beings do it today is continuous. It is not a break with, say, the medieval world, or even the world shortly after the wheel, if our imaginations can take us into the Stone Age. We are rather seeing something like the way people work together and live together updated in a contemporary modality. The problem is that the contemporary modality has a lot of troubles with it. Vast inequalities, starvation, disease, and the threat of ecological disaster. But I think that it helps to get away from those problems. If there is a solution to those problems, I think it is a better shot. We can have a better shot at solving these problems if we don't fight the way in which people dream up stuff and then go and acquire it, because I think it's normal behavior. I don't think it's a result of a capitalist trick or a capitalist moment. If we make friends with material and the way in which the material world fuses with the social and the emotional worlds, then we have, I think, a much better chance at making reforms possible. And that means to change the way in which the envelope of production operates. We're back, in other words, to the same old dilemmas of how to create social democratic institutions, and then back to the new dilemma of how do we construct an envelope of production that is not destructive to the world. It's not about having stuff in the first place. That's what I've been trying to argue. It isn't about the stuff itself. It's for what the stuff means. And that is a great blessing to know that, because it means we can try to find out ways to give people the satisfactions that the stuff is supposed to give them, but in a way that is less destructive. Thank you. Yeah, I'll stand here.
Thank you very much. We've got 15 minutes or so, just 10, 15 minutes for a few questions.
There. I have a question.
Just hang on. There's some people with mics, and even though it's the acoustics
here, I don't need a microphone.
You don't need a microphone.
Can I question you on the capitalist trip? You said that a long run is more profitable because it involves less retooling. But you know, you go back to the light shop 6 months later and you can't match it up because they've changed the design. You know that you just got used to the car one way, and you come back a year later and they change the steering wheel and the door handle, and it's not just minor changes, they've changed the shape of the body completely unnecessarily. So I wonder if you could qualify that. Another capitalist trip talked about the functionality of the Matisse bathtub. But you know that bloody bathtub doesn't work. Have you ever tested it? Have you ever had a bath in it? I'm sure it's great to show your guests, but you know it doesn't work. So I wonder if you are the negative functionality of design.
Let's do that. First of all, on the first issue, the famous phrase "creative destruction" does go on. I think what's interesting is the difference between the way it works from within the process and then what it all amounts to. I think what it all amounts to is that. I have a slide for your side of the argument. Creative destruction. When you actually look at the industrial design process and what people are up to, what they're busily doing, it is overwhelmingly looking for a better mousetrap. I mean, I must say I began this work with something like the imagery that your question implies that you and many other people have. And what you're struck with is overwhelmingly these people are working on a better toothbrush that will get in the crevices. And these other ones are trying to an automobile engine with better mileage. Cars that are safer. The vast majority of it is better mousetrap type stuff, but they are engaged in a competitive race with one another. So although Ford, and I in a way had the qualification built in, Ford wants a very long production run for their cars. They want a very short production run for General Motors cars. And they will do everything they can to create that for General Motors cars, like keep putting out new Fords, until they, in fact, get a majority share of that market niche that they've wanted and build a satisfactory enterprise. So when you look at the system as a whole, it is a very fast-acting turnaround, very fast turnaround time operation because of competitive capitalism. That's what I think is going on in that realm. Let me just say something about, because the critique is, you know, I can hear the critique in your voice. The way to regulate the world is to try to regulate things at the point of production. So, for example, the way to solve an enormous number of our problems is to substitute a new engine for the automobile engine, for the current internal combustion engine, rather than force people to go for smog checks, which they have to do in California, which causes them to resent the government, and rather than resenting the automobile companies. It's And that means if you're going to replace the internal combustion engine or move toward that, you've got to, as radically and quickly as possible, keep making new engine changes. And a lot of what's been going on in engines is, in effect, replacing the internal combustion engine, but over a slow process. I'm sorry, I forgot the second. Just remind me. Oh, yeah. Well, I don't have a bathtub like that, so I haven't test marketed it. I mean, I see no reason why that bathtub isn't a great bathtub. I mean, it's a simple product. I mean, I don't know how it could go wrong. I mean, they know how to make faucets. It's an American Standard Company. I assume they probably have their old ordinary faucets inside that thing.
I saw this design program on TV, and they awarded the first design to this faucet. You call it a faucet, it's a tap. And so Charles Conran awarded it first prize. Then later on, a year later, my father installed that in my bathroom, and the water went all over the place. Since then, I've been cursing Sir Terence Conran.
Uh-huh. Well, there are bad designs. Like there is bad everything. There's bad papers. It's going to shock you. I've been to academic conferences and heard bad papers.
Anybody else? Yes? If you could just wait for the mic, because it does look small, but the acoustics are very bad in this room.
Hi. I quite appreciate your idea about the notion of pre-analytic vision. Can you explain more about the nature of our pre-analytic vision, if one of us will have it? And can you explain that? Do you think whether our pre-analytic vision is affected by this age of information technology and age of globalization? If it does, in what extent?
Wow. I can't define pre-analytic vision very well, because it's that very thing that betrays definition. It's something I think we've all experienced in our lives, that moment of excelsior when we say, it'll look something like that. And it can be as simple as, I'll go to the bakery before I go to the dinner party, and that way I'll have the cake and eat it too. That twist. How has all of this changed by, say, globalization? I think it's changed a lot, because these pre-analytic visions are irresponsible. That is, that's something I can say about them. They are by definition irresponsible. That is, when you're in the shower, which is, I think, where a lot of people have their pre-analytic visions, or in the bathtub, I think that you are beholden to nobody. It's your private world. You can be politically incorrect, you can be dirty, you can be thinking about things that are, you weren't assigned in class that day, whatever. And I think that it's free space and free time, and that's the way to talk about what a pre-analytic vision is. And then cool things can happen. It's like a Zen moment. And I mean, and that's what Zen is about, is getting rid of the other thing, and then clarity and focus can occur. So I think that's why I take showers. So I think that's one of the things going on. About globalism, yeah, I think what global does is it invites the world into our vision. And whereas we may be a checker at Safeway, and there's little opportunity for the world to enter into that task, when we're on our own in the shower, then the globe is there. And that includes wherever it came from, the vapors from the internet, the vapors from our last trip to the museum, our vapors from our children's art.
One or two more? Yes, sir. Yes, sure.
Your last comment made me think about the productivity of what you're calling the pre-analytic moment being precisely in its not being a separate space. So it's precisely because it goes along with all these other things, and it's precisely because analysis or discourse or conscious thoughts are never separate from our daydreams that is productive. And linked to that is, this, you're using this term dream. Theorists who've used this term dream before, like situationist theorists or whatever, see it as revolutionary, transforming. Your dream is a happy American dream, makes things work, makes cars work, makes us buy them, is calm. My dreams are not. And the dream for it, the fact, because it's a mediated space between this pre-analytic and analytic encounters, is changing things. So I just wondered how, you know, your Happy American design story, which is also an historical story about design being incorporated into production for very specific historical reasons, you know, how that also links up with this trash scene here.
Oh, with the trash scene. Well, there's a lot there for me to bite on. The first of all, most of my main story, which is the bathtub story, is a happy British story rather than a happy American story. So, if you go to design studios anywhere in the world, you get essentially the same story, I think. But I think the important point that you're making, you've made a number. One, about the space, the implication I did that you go and have your pre-analytic fantasy in the shower, and then you go to work where you don't have any fantasies, analytic or otherwise maybe. And I did that to emphasize the fact that there is this realm of life. I'm actually, the thrust of my comments is to indeed show connectivity, to try to show the way in which and display the way in which what is taken to be bottom line oriented worlds are in fact filled with things that are other than analytic, other than economic and material and utilitarian. So I'm very happy to take on board the addition that, of course, we never stop dreaming, and we never stop fantasizing, and we never stop a pre-analytic apparatus going on, or at least I'm willing to entertain that. I think that, in fact, there are various pathologies of life and pathologies of moments where one, in fact, has lost track of that those things, and that capacity is, in fact, not operating so well. And I think all of us in our work have had those moments where we're on a track, we can't get out, we're not getting anywhere, and we've got to do something to break that pattern so that we can loosen up and other things that can happen. I take that as evidence that they sometimes are to different degrees sequential and temporal. And again, I get back to Zen, which for me is an effort to try to, in fact, institute that kind of a process, institute that kind of a space. In terms of the, you asked me about this, didn't you, at the end? Oh, I see what you're getting at. Everything I did was happy. Mm-hmm. There's great darkness, and we'll go to war. I mean, nuclear war. All war is about fantasies. The wheel, and all of these things are also often about inequality. They're about status. They're about differentiation. I mean, there's a lot of unhappy stories to tell. I think the reason why I'm such a happy guy tonight is that the unhappy dominates this realm altogether. And so therefore, to talk about stuff is to document the way in which it destroys consciousness and the world. And what I'm trying to do is to say that it is the world, all of it, for better or worse, for good or evil. And knowing that, we can get around to making it better. Like, for example, specifying content, like outlawing nuclear weapons. I mean, there's a lot of work to be done, but it will be done within this kind of realm, that Mussolini got people excited because a lot of theater was happening, and it regardless of what you think about it aesthetically, it needs to be beat back aesthetically.
I'm afraid, one more at the back there.
Yeah, I'd just like to know if there's a particular prosaic item that you continually encounter in your daily life that just bedevils you with its bad industrial design and what that is.
I talked about the bathtub. I think that's an obvious one. The VCR is, and I'm not the inventor of that critique. Everybody's written about VCRs. Talk about the VCRs horrible. London crosswalks. That's a killer, literally. Those would be my top three. not in order of how I feel.
Yes, we had a year ago, we had a visiting professor, or maybe it's 2 years ago, Colin Ward, who talked about reflections in water. And one of the things which has stuck with me is, you know, how much and how important water is to so many people in the world, especially to people in the less developed countries, especially to women, and how much of a woman's daily routine is taken up with dealing with problems of water, hygiene, and so forth. And yet you refer to the glistening bathtub as a place where more people die there than elsewhere. Harvey, most people in the world don't have access to the glistening bathtub.
Yes.
This astounds me. You know, as a place to wash, much less as a place to die. I do find it really worrying that you can sort of so quickly dismiss inequality, environmental destruction, almost as an added phrase, almost as industrial designers use the word attribute, design attribute. It has an attribute, something. It's designed to be have a certain weight, a certain quality. It has a performance. It will go a certain speed. It has a value. It satisfies an emotional need, a practical need. And incidentally, in that design language, price is not the value. Price is a performance indicator. But here you speak of it like it's an added-on thing. And I find it a bit scary. It's almost like you're going to design a better world. It reminds me of New Labour in Britain, the place of design in New Labour. It in fact, doesn't even go so far as Mussolini's fascination with design and modernism, which had a program of political action behind it, frightening as that particular program is. These are concerns which sort of are boiling up inside me as I speak, as I listen to you, and a bit more so as I speak.
Mm-hmm. Could you start by...
Well, first of all, you need to, I was going to take a bath. That's the. No, on the moral issues, I just would declare I'm a highly moral person, so no worries on that front. I will say again that I am trying to give voice to some ideas that I think aren't voiced, and so I take people's time up to do something new. The issues about inequality in the world and ecological disaster, I really feel I have nothing new to say, or at least based on this work. And this is a room which has had a vast number of people commenting on that. And I've been to quite a few of their talks. And it's done. It hasn't worked. But the talk part, I think, is largely done. And so I'm here to share some things that I thought would be fresh and that people didn't have access to. Yes, the majority of people in the world probably don't have any bathtub. And I thought I quivered in my voice when I made the comment. There was at least a laughter, which I assume recognized that quiver, when I said that more people died in bathtubs than anywhere else. Okay, not true. I think most people knew that that it wasn't true. The issue, though, that you really are being driven by is an absolute profound one. And I did think that I wanted to try to say something relevant to that. The left has alienated vast publics because it treats people's materialism with ridicule. And that's because it doesn't recognize the way in which their material world is filled with emotional, social connections that are extremely important to them. And that set of concerns goes into the production, which is what I talked about today, and it also goes into the consumption, which is the other half of my work, but which I just didn't have a chance to get to. And we will never reform the society and play a leading role in it if we ridicule people for what they take as so important in their lives, and they take it as important in their lives for very good reason. And I think we should acknowledge those reasons so that we can then get to the position and of trying to indeed, if you don't like the word engineer, but that's what it's about, because these products are engineered with different consequences on life and life chances. And that is my ultimate goal.
I think we have to end here. And I hate saying, well, I love saying I told you so. So if you go back to my introduction, I think what Harvey said vindicated many of the things I said about him. And I remember one of the things he told me in trying to get us to visit him in Santa Barbara was that if I looked out of the office window, I would see a palm tree and a student with a surfboard walking past. And it was true, there was a student with a surfboard. I don't know what the LSE equivalent is, nothing like that. Five students in an elevator with mobile phones. But I hope we can reverse the role of us looking out, and thank Harvey for bringing something of California and its palm trees to us today. And he will be here till the end of the year, and I think instead of us looking out at the window, people are very welcome to look in his window and talk to him about these subjects. Thanks very much.
Yeah, I might mention that Monica Walensky is on television tonight.